Welcome to the Pain Podcast, presented by Le Peuple Scientifique. We are thrilled to bring you a platform that unites clinicians, researchers, and pain advocates in sharing a pursuit, understanding pain. In this series of podcasts, we aim to bridge the gap between scientific knowledge and practical applications in the field of pain. Our episodes will feature insightful discussions with leading experts, exploring the latest research findings, innovative treatments, and emerging trends in the realm of pain. Whether you are a healthcare professional seeking evidence-based practices, a researcher diving into the depths of the pain mechanisms, or a dedicated advocate striving to improve the lives of individuals in pain, you are welcome. Check out our website, get confident and competent in treating pain. Start today.
Okay, welcome to the Pain Podcast, and I am the host today, Tim Beams. I'm the founder of Le Peuple Scientifique, and I'm really excited to, continue our discussion with Dr. Deepak Ravindran, and just a little about Deepak. You strike me as someone who is slightly different from the norm in terms of being a medical doctor working in pain, because you have quite a broad interest in, for instance, trauma-informed care, lifestyle medicine, etc. So this is I feel like this is the discussion for us to really dip our toes in. You've got a clinical interest. You work as a doctor in the NHS, also privately. You do a little bit of. You've connected with Reading University as well, aren't you? And in terms of the services that you're involved with, not just pain, but also you have involvement in fibromyalgia and long COVID, I believe, as well.
Yeah.
So quite a broad background. We'll talk about it in a little bit. You've got a great book that we have the audio version coming out soon. So I'd love to introduce that to people. And you've been involved in a number of different projects, including things like the Curable app, I believe, as well, weren't you? I had a patient tell me about that this week and mention your name. So there we go. So you were mentioned in dispatches. and I might add, they were benefiting greatly from it as well. So, really, really great to see that out there. So... thanks for joining me, first of all.
No, thank you, Tim, for having me. It's really wonderful. And I love your work. I love the work they've been doing at Le Peuple, all the online and the offline events, even before the pandemic. I've attended a couple in some pubs in London. So it's great to connect and to sort of officially be on the Le Peuple here as well. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant, brilliant. Thank you so much. So I'm really intrigued, first of all, in... like taking a personal perspective here, but how you see yourself in relation to your, for instance, your peers. So the other consultants working in pain medicine, where do you see and how do you feel yourself to be within those setting?
Well, so many people have asked me that in so many different ways there. So this is a new way to kind of see where I am. And yes, I must agree. I think some of my ways of thinking in the last few years, especially, have been modified by and I must say, I credit a lot to the business management course that I did in the Henley School, which was sponsored by my organization. And in a way that got me thinking, well, actually, what is it that patients need? And in some ways, it goes down to this Japanese principle of ikigai. You know, what I'm good at, what the world needs, what is somebody that will, you know, pay for, but actually, what do I love? And in some ways, I love pain medicine. I love this subdivision of anesthetics when I was doing my degree there and I did the fellowship. I thought this was one exciting place where I saw the potential for new discoveries, new understanding of the brain to potentially give us some opportunities for managing. I did train in the traditional way of, you know, interventions and medications, because that's what I learned mostly in the pain fellowship. And I came out armed with that knowledge. And pretty soon I realized that while I loved the subject and the opportunities it gave, what I was achieving as outcomes with my patients wasn't really matching up with what I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point of time, this understanding that, you know, yes, what people actually need is the understanding of pain. There was this big gap in actually how do we raise awareness? How do we bring about some kind of not behavior change, but at least that understanding related change in perception and management? And that's where I thought, well, I need to reframe my entire way of approaching it. And if what patients need and the people need are a broader perspective of how we look at pain itself and the complexity of pain, then could I modify myself to position myself in that place wherein I can bridge this part here? So the analogy I kind of think of myself is, there is this strong, the biomedical model, as it were, which we all grew up in, and that's on one side of the a cliff. You've got the deep crevice and gorge in between, and you've got a lot of camps in that biomedical side, each occupied by each one kind of specialism that has a biomedical view of it. And then on the other side of the cliff, you've got the neuroscience, the mind-body approach, everybody on the other side there. And we're expecting patients to go past these camps and find ways to vault across to the new science of the mind body, the better way of understanding, recovering, and finding their way of managing or overcoming their pain. And I thought, well, somebody needs to be at that in-between phase to start constructing bridges and actually be at that bridge entry point to guide those that are coming past the camps or through the camps and take them across. And so where I think is that there is a need for more healthcare professionals. And actually there are already quite a lot of people who are in that bridging space. I think I'm just probably one of the medical doctors who are also occupying that space. There are a lot of people like me. When I look across, there's the US, they're there. So I think our tribe of this kind of medical doctors who are looking at guiding and giving patients a much more, whether you call it holistic or integrative or lifestyle medicine based, the names change, but I think the view is, if we recognize pain as a complex condition existing in a complex human being, existing in a complex adaptive system, then we need to be able to recognize where they are and then create tailored approaches to get them across this gorge and this crevice to the other side.
Lovely. Yeah, I like the analogy, actually. So I'm really intrigued. I suppose what am I doing here is I'm trying to be a fly on the wall of a consultation or a session that you have with people. Do you find that you're ever met with resistance or is resistance to that, you know, you bridging that gap, present in many people?
It's a lot less now. I think what I try a lot to do in my clinical consultations is, in my head, I have reframed each consultation as an opportunity for a micro change. And so every consultation of mine, whether it's private or NHS, is figured out, okay, here's this person, what's their story? And personally, what is it that they had expected I would be able to do? So I kind of sense check what their expectations were. And in my head is the model of Prochaska's, you know, theory of change. So if I sense from their language that they are probably in the pre-contemplation phase, then I really don't try to push. And I recognize that ambivalence is a very normal human trait. And so if they don't know what to do, they don't know what to expect, they are not sure what they wanted from a consultation with me, then I just sense and try to sense where they are at and actually then say, well, they are seeing me for the first time. All they have is one attempt at credibility that they've come into a doctor and I've already set up a hierarchy out there. So how many different ways can I actually establish rapport? So the whole consultation then is about rapport building, about listening, and then finding one opportunity to actually say, and in team, Tim, actually, there's this very interesting set of, I don't think there's an evidence-based theory with it, but there's this concept of the 7-11. So you need for someone to kind of change or go on a path. Apparently, the suggestion is that they need to have listened about 7 hours of content around there and been exposed to an average of 11 touch points of various kinds of hearing the same content in a variety of points before they can attempt any change or think about ambivalence to contemplation and making action. And I don't know when the person is sitting in the consultation with me is, am I the first, am I the last, or am I just a passing phase in between? So for me, I try to be that point there wherein I can sow one seed of at least a micro change, one opportunity for hope to say it's possible. And if I find there in the pre-contemplation phase, I say, you know, here's all the resources. Here's a variety of resources. Do you listen to audio? Do you listen to video? Do you like written word? These are the options. These are the thoughts. These are the possibilities. However, if they say, well, no, I just want a drug or I want an injection because when I came in, I thought you're the one who gives out a drug and gives an injection, then the conversation can be, okay, fine, I'll do that. But if it doesn't work, so I just raise that one bit of ambivalence. If it doesn't work, what are your options next? Any attempt at self-efficacy? Is there a possibility of supporting? So those are what makes each of my consultations. I try to liven them up because otherwise there's a big challenge that we all think of our chronic pain patients as, oh my God, a heart sink. And for me, that trauma-informed approach is not why are they like this, but what might have happened to them in their conversations prior to them sitting in my room expecting those things from me, and what can I do to shift one thing towards the right direction?
Yeah, lovely. And people, as they're listening, they're probably thinking, oh, this is lovely to hear. You've considered so much there. In fact, there's so much there, I'm wondering where we go. You've dropped in a few themes I think we could visit. I'm intrigued, first of all, around behavior change, and you mentioned about Prochaska's model, and so for me, for instance, when I'm working with someone, I may be able to see them over a relatively long period of time. Is that possible for you, or like how can you be a part of a longer term behavioral change relating to someone's persistent pain, for instance?
Really great question there. That is where my thoughts are for the last few years, is how can I be part of that long-term journey. My views right now are that it's important to create an ecosystem wherein I can be part of the journey. And that's what's driven a lot of my actions and strategies over the last few years in terms of the social media, in terms of the books, in terms of the collaborations, is to try to create that ecosystem where they see change is possible, where they see hope is possible, where they see recovery as an option, and they see lived experience of that recovery being manifest and visible, so they can know that it doesn't look out of reach, it is possible. I think that to me, behavior change, it's influenced a lot by some of the understanding around complexity and how we behave in complexity, is that expecting people to change is very difficult, and we are setting ourselves up for a real challenging time if we want somebody to change. What's probably easier and has a lower energy gradient and coefficient to change would be to create the processes and interactions wherein you facilitate that change to happen. And, you know, and in that sense, I've dipped a lot into sort of the habit literature. You've got all these guys from James Clear to Charles Duhigg to BJ Fogg. But there was one interesting book that I was reading just a few months ago. It's by David McRaney, How Minds Change. And he's come from the concept of, well, how do people change? You know, for example, he talks about this concept that in 20 years' time, the entire view of the LGBTQ way we think about it in the US, within two election cycles, we've changed the mindset of an entire generation of people. How is that possible? And it's so tricky. And I kind of think, well, if we want to change pain neuroscience to help people understand that pain is not just about an issue in the tissue, and you need to look bigger, we maybe need to step outside the traditional neuroscience education approaches alone to actually say, what are the cultural aspects we can shift? What are the ecosystem changes we can do to facilitate that? And that's where my thoughts are right now in terms of saying, well, if we now want behavior change, Prochaska's is a nice clinical place to, well, say, okay, you know what do I do in this 30 minutes or 40 minutes? But as you rightly said, Tim, I can't see them maybe once every 3 to 4 months. Maybe with private patients, I may have the option to see them more often. But within the NHS, that's quite tricky to do. And in a secondary care setup, it is more challenging. And sometimes I think these are the right times to probably dip into community or primary care, because you can harness then the potential of, for example, group consultations, wherein you can create an ecosystem where you can be more present and visible. You can use peer support and lived experience to scaffold, to create a scaffolding that people will feel, look at support. And that's what David McRaney actually talks about in the book, is when finally people change and they've been wedded to one model. So imagine a patient who's wedded to a biomedical model, brought up in a society which tells him that pain is something in the tissue and needs another scan, he or she or they, whichever that, you know, being politically correct. When you want them to then adopt a bigger picture, I can do something for myself. And if I do A, B, C, and D, I can help, but I know when to go back to expertise when required. I need to then create that alternative framework and show them that there is some place to go. So in the same analogy that I use, I need to show them the other side of the cliff. I need to show them the bridge. I need to say there are more people on the bridge like you. So it's safe for you to come, so that when you leave this framework of the biomedical, there's someone to receive you. You're not left in limbo land. And I think that's the true sustainable behavior change right now, in my view. So the question for me is, how can I create an ecosystem where processes and interactions are healthier to allow for that to thrive, rather than saying you ought to change, why are you not changing, or it's all the society, and you know, and then leave it. So it's a challenging problem, but it's an interesting and intriguing problem for which there are multiple approaches, and the aim is you need to have multiple parallel, safe to fail approaches in a complex system.
It's lovely. You're just massaging my biases here, so thanks very much.
Thankfully, in an audio podcast, we can't really do that on live. Yes.
I'm intrigued. I think there's a couple of things that I come from that I'm really interested in, and you've used the word ecosystem, and I'm wondering whether complexity and complexity systems or science it sort of fits with that notion. I'm not sure. but with that in mind, you're just sort of setting out, but we haven't given it full shape of what that could look like. Should we be, for instance, you said about some group work and learning and peer support and lived experience, and the thing that I'm wondering is that we go beyond that, and what could that look like? What are your thoughts about going sort of, I suppose would that just be a bigger, like a bigger system perhaps, or a bit more widely?
Interesting. I've been putting some thought into it in my idle time. So I'm very influenced by a person called Dave Snowden. He, no connection to the WikiLeaks whistleblower on there. but he's in the field of knowledge management. He's a kind of guru in the field of knowledge management and agile, so lean models, you know, that kind of construction and IT network. But he comes up with an interesting framework. He's Welsh, and his framework is called the Canavan framework. Canavan is C-Y, pronounced and spelled C-Y-N-E-F-I-N. So pronounce it how you like, but he likes to call it Canavan. And essentially, it's a framework for looking at how you make decisions in complexity, and how, if we think we are leaders or decision makers or deciders of what action we take, his proposal is to look at nature and system and identify, first of all, what system you are in before you decide what action you take. And his talk is about saying, well, there are essentially four kinds of systems. So there are three systems in nature. So nature has got three systems. There are the organized, there's complex, and there's chaotic. There's three big systems. Within the organized system, he has one thing where it's everything is clear. So you have clear connection between cause and effect. And that's the best place for getting best practice in and having clear guidelines in place and or have all the best options there. The other part of the organized system is what he calls a complicated domain. In the complicated domain, you do have some connection between cause and effect. You might need an expert of some kind to help sort out some of the bits, but you can eventually solve that. That's the place for good practice. You can get reasonable guidelines for good practice in there. The third domain, that is the second part of our system, is the complex system. And in complexity, there is no relation between cause and effect at all. There is very little understanding of what's going to lead to what. There are hidden forces and there are visible forces, and you don't know what the constraints are. There is context dependency, and there is always going to be unintended consequences. We start from the understanding of the system that's there. And then, of course, the third system in nature is the chaotic system, which is very transitional, ephemeral, and doesn't last long. And he talks about a confused domain in all of this, when sometimes we are faced with situations wherein we cannot identify what exactly is happening in the situation. So it's very applicable to healthcare. And if you bear with me with this analogy, there is within pain management and within healthcare itself, my contention is that the biggest challenge with the biomedical model is our flawed understanding to say that everything is clear and complicated. We somehow think that we start from a prior assumption that we already know cause and effect, when actually there is very little in healthcare that sits in the clear and complicated domain. Because as far as most general healthcare and chronic disease management and pain management especially is concerned, it sits in what we call sort of the top left of the framework, which is the complex domain. And if we start from that point that the patient sitting before me in chronic pain is sitting in a complex adaptive system, I do not know what the reason for his flare-up or flare-up is. It could be a variety of things which we are aware of, some of which is, you know, the hidden constraints might be the genetics or the epigenetics, which we don't know, or the traumas that don't come through. The visible ones might be what they say. They can recognize and disclose some of the societal and the cultural and financial impacts, but they may not. I get some information from scans, but maybe not all of them. And in all of this situation, if we start from the complex domain, and the principles of operating in the complex domain are, you can only influence the vector of travel. You can influence the direction in which it has to go, but you cannot have a goal. You cannot get them, I will get you pain-free, but you can say, well, this is the direction to go. If you consider that you want to do an injection, then it will slip into the complicated domain, because then you can adopt the mode of these are the steps to do a right injection. This is the way to get it correct. This is the way to do a physiotherapy maneuver. This is the way to do a particular tendon exercise. But then they slip back into the complex domain when they live their daily life. And there you would have to do multiple small trials. Patients will be doing that. That's what they do daily life. That's what their daily life is. do something small. If it works, that's good. What we do in neuroscience terms, we say is that, okay, if it does work, it's neuroplasticity, something's changing. We define it in ways, but at a system level, I find this framework quite useful because then everything is dependent on rapport, everything is dependent on trust, everything is dependent on the narrative. In complex adaptive systems, it's their narrative that's going to shape how they're going to view the vector of their travel. So anything to enhance those things. And if you find that there are the least energy gradients, because the brain is an energy intensive organ, human change is an energy intensive thing. So they will, and by nature, we will choose convenience. So if we are going to get them to move in one direction, they will choose the one that is least energy consuming. So we need to then, as leaders and decision makers and policy makers or system designers, we need to create an ecosystem in which the vectors become visible, the energy gradient is as low as possible for the right things to happen. Whether that is governmental change in terms of saying you should ban and put a tax on sugar, that may be one way of reducing the energy gradient. Whether you have some things that are clearly identified as illegal or legal, that's a way of energy gradient. So if you think of it, there are system processes, but maybe that's where, as senior leaders and influencers and policy makers, we need to be influencing the right kind of people to say, how can you create an ecosystem wherein the energy gradient is low, given that we are operating in a system where there are going to be unintended consequences, and we as leaders need to manage some of those unintended consequences. You shut down Fasigen injections and you say low commissioning and do that, there are going to be unintended consequences because you've set such clear guidelines. You've taken a complex thing, you put it in a clear thing saying everybody with back pain will not get it. The push is you go to such an extent wherein people then fall off the cliff because they go private, they go somewhere else, they get a wrong set of misinformation. So we've lost the whole battle of doing too much commissioning, too much deprioritization, too much deprescribing. So those are the challenges we need to be aware of when we try to do things that we see in the NHS, pretending that we live in a clear and a complicated system.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm really glad that you dropped some of that in there, because it is intriguing, isn't it? That it strikes me, and perhaps this is where we can just go for a couple of minutes, is that there might be fairly simple opportunities for behavioural change that actually may have a real benefit in the process of a recovery or the journey into recovery, that are quite difficult for some people to access. And I wonder, like you mentioned about tax on sugar, and I'm just wondering, like, if we could just visit one topic I know is dear to your heart, is around nutrition and the sort of growing idea around microbiome as well. But where do you sort of currently see nutrition relating to pain in whichever direction, whichever vector?
I mean, a lot of what I write in my book as well, Tim, you know, so it's called the pain-free mindset, which sometimes puts people off. But for me, the mindset itself is an acronym. That is, M stands for medications, I is interventions, N is neuroscience, D is diet, S is sleep, E is exercise and movement, and T is therapies of mind and body. My whole thing is that itself is a complexity, sort of a hat tip to complexity, because we don't know which assortment and combination of this is going to be the right toolkit for the patient to move ahead in their journey and enable them in the vector. And they need to try small bits of this. Medications and interventions are part of the established model anyway, and they can always access that more easily than other things. But the in other parts, sleep and therapies of mind, body, nutrition, and you know, exercise or movement, again, some of them can be accessed there. Nutrition is the one part where we think they can access, but what my feeling is that it's a very tangible, it's a very easy, or rather relatively easy, it's something that they do every day. They have to eat and have that option. They can choose to not exercise. They can choose to forego sleep. They can choose to not do any mind-body techniques. But nutrition is going to be required. And since 60% of chronic pain patients will have comorbidities, there is already an ecosystem and a theme that's going on in primary care and community care with lifestyle medicine for metabolic health, for diabetes, for asthma, for all of these things. There is this already a growing movement of people saying why we should eat healthy and why that kind of eating a certain kind of food can make a difference to ABC in metabolic health. That is a low energy gradient already. If we can then help our patients understand why nutrition and pain matter, why understanding that the most of chronic pain may have a neuroimmune component and influencing the immune system through diet because it is present predominantly in the gut. So attempting to modulate the microbiome and by changing the kind of diet and using small triggers, small habits to influence neuroplasticity through that way, and that could reduce central sensitization, seems to be something that at a academic level, I could persuade the clinicians to take notice of it because it would appeal to their academic liking. At a patient level, it's something that they're already doing probably for their diabetes or asthma, COPD, they've been giving their information. If we become, as a department, as a specialty, as a pain management program, as a physio, psychology, health coach, lived experience consultant, also be part of the message, then it comes back to the same thing. I may be the first person, I may be the 11th person, but I would be coming at the same message, asking them to do something that's already being suggested everywhere. And that means that I could become one of the voices to say why you should eat well. And with regards to pain, offer them a logical, rational argument to say it's possible to eat well and notice a difference in pain, which is natural, which is not drug related with limited side effects and potentially sustainable because you're already eating. So we're just asking you to consider eating something healthy. And again, it's a minefield on, you know, whether you do intermittent fasting, whether you eat everything you want, but you eat within a window or don't eat some things at all. I'm not going to get into that part there. But the simple message that food and the kind of food and the time of food that you eat can have a potentially beneficial effect on your pain. And that is independent of everything else you're doing. You can still do all the other stuff. To me, that's a simple message. That's a potentially easy to sell message. And in the ecosystem of primary and community care, where group consultations are already happening for obesity, for diabetes, for asthma, I feel it could be a relatively easy win, low energy, something that fits into the ecosystem, one more interaction that goes in the right direction, one more process to be part of. The only thing that the people in primary care need is a content around saying what constitutes an anti-inflammatory diet, what are the recipes. And I think that what's important when you come to food is what I call culturally congruent concepts. You have to have the triple C. We need to get, you can't sell a Mediterranean diet to a Southeast Asian or an Oriental, you know, or somebody from the Eastern side. You can't sell. So you need to be culturally congruent in what you decide and prescribe. But those are options for thinking, and that's the innovation that's waiting to happen. You know, why can't we use AI and ChatGPT style to create a recipe that is culturally congruent and is still anti-inflammatory? And reduce the energy coefficient for them to actually say, you know what, I could do this. All this stuff is only $3 to buy from the local produce place. And, you know, it's possible. It's done in Chicago for diabetes. What's stopping us from doing it for pain in Berkshire?
Lovely. Yeah, and it's great to hear your passion as well. And I get a sense, and this is lovely to hear, but if people are listening, there are things that can be done, and we can support that process as well. If you're a clinician out there, you know, if we're supporting each other with some congruent messaging, For instance, around healthy diet, sleep, exercise, etc., that you've mentioned here today. So, yeah, would be great, wouldn't it? You might not be the one that causes that, but you're part of that process that allows.
I think that's the beauty of a consultation. I kind of feel, if I'm the 11th person, the penny would drop in front of me, and I'd have a really good day that day because I've been it. Yeah. If I'm not, I might be the first or the seventh or sixth or seventh. And, you know, it's taken off a lot of pressure from my consulting that I don't have to be the fixer.
Yeah.
Because I'm operating in a complex system. All I'm doing is part of the process. If I can't fix, that's fine. The next time they come, I'll try a different style of messaging, a different technique, a different way to establish rapport and see something else that might stick. It's taken off a lot. Clinically, I don't feel that pressure that I used to feel 4 or 5 years ago that, you know, oh God, I don't have an intervention to offer because this intervention won't get approved or commissioned. I can't give this medication because this patient has already done 7 or 8 medications. What am I going to do? That is often a feeling that a lot of my colleagues have said. That is a lot of, you know, that results in the potential for a consultation to go south or not go the right way, and, you know, we put our defenses up. I find that I don't have to deal that much. Yes, I might occasionally, you know, closer to lunchtime when the hunger pangs are coming through, I might have a different way I react to the consultation. I might have an evening time where it's running that's there. You know, that's human behavioral change. But by and large, I don't hold myself fully responsible and that I must be the fixer. I am the facilitator. I'm the guide. I'm there to give you the options and be with you on your journey, sometimes behind, sometimes in front, sometimes mostly alongside.
Yeah, brilliant. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but it's really great to hear your perspective. And it's interesting, isn't it, just seeing change as well. So hearing that 4 or 5 years ago, or whenever it was, that what you were thinking then is changing, and it sounds like quite radically as well, changing over the years. So it's really interesting to think, well, you know, in 5 years' time, look where we're going to be in the field.
It is, you know. If I may just say that my dealing and setting up with the long COVID service in the last 2 years, 3 years of pandemic has again made me aware there might very well be very clear biomedical opportunities because of the way we are understanding conditions like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and long COVID with all these basic science research, which seems to be identifying all kinds of mitochondrial changes. That's something we never studied about. And all of a sudden, when you look at the literature, you see there's so much around mitochondrial problems and pain and central sensitization. And I kind of think, well, what can we learn from here? Maybe there is something at a biological level that is happening, which might still require something that comes from the traditional biomedical sphere to pick up. But it doesn't change that the patient still needs a bigger level of support in an ecosystem that should allow them to feel part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Lovely. It's a nice balanced opinion. So thanks for that. Deepak, huge thanks. We've mentioned your book. It's called The Pain-Free Mindset, 7 Steps to Taking Control and Overcoming Chronic Pain. And you've got a little flavor of the topics that might be in there as well. You'll be able to get that as an audio version as well very, very soon, if not now, depending on when we release this. And I just want to say a huge, huge thanks and all the very best.
Thank you, Tim, for having me. Really great to chat this morning.